Okay, today, if you're looking there at Acts 19, verse 1, we're only going to cover the most of one verse, and then we're going to jump off a little bit on a little side excursion from the text, but still kind of moving chronologically in the same direction. We have a place here in Acts where Paul has just begun his third journey. He actually starts that in the previous chapter, in chapter 18, the last few verses there. And we learn that he took off again from Antioch, and he has journeyed across to the west, gone through some of the areas that he's been before. This time, this will be the fourth time that he passes through these parts as he goes through Galatia and then Phrygia, and makes his way over to Asia. You remember that when I've referred to Asia, I'm referring to a Roman province, which includes a large part of the western end of Asia Minor. It was divided up when the Romans took over, and so that division really includes a lot of regions that have different names, but this large area is a defined area that has Roman control and authority as they divided things up and gave them governors. So it's a very large province and includes many of the cities that we've been talking about and we'll continue to talk about. Paul was about to enter into Asia here, really for the first time going into that inner territory of Asia. You remember that he previously wanted to desperately. He's had an ambition to do that for probably about 4 years now as he approaches Asia again in that border. And this time, there's nothing holding him back, and so he's ready to go to the west. And so verse 19 says that, "And it came to pass that while Apollos was at Corinth, Paul, having passed through the upper coast, came to Ephesus." That's where we're going to stop, because I'm going to jump off right here. But I want you to notice something interesting about this verse. Now, Apollos was a disciple in Ephesus, and he was ready to, he actually had gone to Corinth, and he's there at the present time. And Paul is about to, now on the heels of that, to follow in to Asia, and his destination is Ephesus. That's really, really wants to go cross country through Asia and find his way to Ephesus. And on the map here, you can get a sense of that. If you look over on the right side, a little off the map is where he is right now at the border of Asia. Asia includes pretty much all of the territory shown there and about half again as much to the north. That's how big Asia is. And so there's some debate on exactly what his route was, and it all hinges on one word, which in the King James is coast. The word coast really doesn't mean coast like the edge of the ocean. It really means borders or regions. So when we talk about the upper regions or borders, there's a suggestion that he may have taken sort of an upper route, which would have taken him from over here across and this way, as opposed to down this way to get to Ephesus. If he had gone this lower route, he would have passed through a number of cities like Colossae and Laodicea, and then down the Meander River Valley. The upper or northern route would have taken him perhaps through Philadelphia and then through the Hermas River Valley and down the River Valley, the Caistor River Valley, into Ephesus. Now, I'm going to suggest that he very likely took that upper route just based on the terminology in the verse, but nobody knows for sure. If he had taken that upper route, though, you can see that he would have passed through Philadelphia, and then he would have come to Sardis. There's a major road that connects there, and then there's another fairly major road that connects Sardis down into Ephesus. So it's not unreasonable that this is the way he might have gone. If he had done this, then the implication is that he actually passed through some of these towns, such as Sardis, which is the one I want to look at a little bit more today. Another reason people think that he may have taken this upper route is because, based on the letter to the Colossians, it gives the impression that he never actually visited Colossae. So that would be another reason why he maybe was kind of working his way around that area to visit a lot of these inner towns and cities on his way to Ephesus, since this was his first big opportunity to get in there and minister in that area. So today, I'm going to stop short of his going to Ephesus, and I'm going to talk a little bit about things that may have happened along the way, that if it wasn't Paul, it would at this time it might have he might have being that close to Ephesus come to Sardis in his ministry there in Ephesus, or one of the other disciples, even John, who lived there a long time, may have been in this area. In any case, it's very likely that Sardis heard the gospel at a fairly early time, and being only about 88 miles from Ephesus, this is very likely, especially since you consider that Ephesus actually had believers in it even before the time that Paul got there. Just a few verses back in Acts 18, we read that Aquila and Priscilla actually called on some brethren in that area in Ephesus who had been there to write some reference letters for Apollos when he went off to Corinth. So there's reason to believe that Sardis heard the gospel at an early time. And that's just just something to hinge the next part of the discussion on. There was an article in the Missionary Herald magazine in 1911, and a Turkish archaeologist named C.C. Tracy from Marsavan, which is up near the Black Sea, had come down to observe an archaeological team from Princeton that was working in Sardis at the time. And he saw much of what they were doing. He saw that they had just discovered the Temple of Artemis, and they had also in that area discovered 3,000 relics that included utensils and ornaments and of gold and precious materials and stones and so forth. But he said what impressed him the most was the significance of those seven churches of Asia that had been named by the Apostle John, of which Sardis was one. And he went on to write, "When I think of the myriads of various nationality and advanced civilization for whose evangelization these churches were responsible, the letters, that is the letters of Revelation to the churches, to the Christian communities, occupying the splendid strategic centers fill me with awe. While established amid the splendors of civilization, they were set as candlesticks in the midst of gross spiritual darkness." And then he asked this question. He said, did they fulfill their mission? And that's what I want us to think about today, is the background and context of cities like Sardis, as I've just kind of described the picture of that situation at that time, and the and how that affected the apostles' ministry, how that fit in to their mission and ministry in Asia, and how it affects us today in the way we look at the mission that we have. So to do that, I'm going to first take you to Asia for a bit of a look there. And I will. There it goes. Okay. Keep pointing this in the wrong direction. If you were to go there, just as if perhaps Paul did, as he came across that along that main highway on his way to Ephesus, this is what you would see. On the north side, standing on the north side in the lower city and looking up, you'd see the Acropolis. Now, you know by now all these ancient cities that we've looked at, that it was very common for the ancient time, the ancient version of the city to be built as a fortress on a hill. And Sardis was no exception. The cities that were the most powerful had an Acropolis that was part of their ancient defensive structure. And this is the one at Sardis. It's on the northern edge of a little ridge of mountains called the Tmolus Mountain. And it's a spur that's kind of on the north side that formed this Acropolis. And it's about 1,500 feet high. And it basically was the original fortress of that city. On the side was the Pactolus River on the right side to the west, and it formed almost like a moat to the entrance to the Acropolis, so it provided even further defense. This is a view from a drone looking from the north at the Acropolis and gives you a better picture of it. You can see some of the old foundation walls of the ancient city, which were very significant for the history of this particular city. It had a larger flat area on the top in ancient times, but erosion has kind of taken its toll. And in order to really get a feel for this and the feel of the Acropolis, I want to take you all the way to that peak in the middle, the very top point. So put on your mountain boots and follow me up to there. You need to not drag behind, but come on along, keep up with us as we climb up the skirts of that mountain and get up to the top of the Acropolis. As we get near the top, I can actually come up around the foundation stones. Much of those fortress walls are still there. And then going further and watching your step, you can get even higher up toward that peak spot in the middle and look way out to the west, which would have been sort of the entrance to the Acropolis, and see part of the south end of the city. And then finally, you could climb all the way to the top. There we are, to the very peak. And if you're not too dizzy by now, you would be at a spot where you could really see out and have a view and a safe, secure spot. You can imagine how safe someone would feel with walls around them at this top place on the Acropolis. Looking out to the northwest in the Hermus River Valley, far out in that direction, you'd see a large plain. And this stretched out for many miles. In fact, if you look off at the haze far in the distance at the horizon, about 30 miles away, is the city of Thyatira. Remember, we've been there before, so that should be familiar. And if you looked off to the east along the river valley in this direction, you'd see the extension of that valley going there, and you see a road that passes right along here. That was the main road, not just the Roman road, but it dated back to the time of the Persians. It was called the Royal Road, and it was built in the time of Cyrus, and actually ended here in Sardis. It was a very significant road and went all the way back 1,600 miles to Susa. So you can imagine how important the road was, and how important this spot where Sardis was located. And then looking just down at the bottom of the Acropolis on the north side, you would see the lower city. You can see the remains there in the middle of some that's been excavated. So this gives you a feel for what it was like to be in Sardis at that time, and it had an ancient history that went far back from the first century. The history begins far back, about 1300 BC, when the Lydian kingdom, which is really the major powerful history of the kings of Sardis, started. And they came from a kingdom even before that, which was the Hittite kingdom. And it was many of the descendants of the Hittites that probably made up the people of the Lydian kingdom, which in its greatest extent was much bigger even than that province of Asia that I showed you, but extended over about half of what was Asia Minor. The Hittites you probably remember from many stories in the Bible. I can think of just one right off back in the days of Elisha, when Samaria, the northern city of Samaria, was being besieged by the Syrians. And the Lord brought the sound of chariots to scare the Syrian army, and they all ran off and left everything. And the Syrians believed that it was the great army of the Hittites that had been hired to come and fight. So about that time, the Lydian kings took over and built a powerful empire, of which Sardis became the capital. They had a huge area in the plain, bigger even than the Giza Plateau in Egypt, where they buried their kings and royalty. And this is called, it's a little hard to see there, it's called Bintepe, the Turkish name for 1,000 mounds. That just stretched for miles and miles and miles. You can see these ancient burial mounds that are still there today. And so the kingdom was well known, had a number of kings, and went on for a number of centuries. The history has a number of myths associated with it. One of them is the tale of King Midas, but it helps in understanding that, how the people of Sardis thought and what influenced them. So I just want to quickly relate that tale and how it affects the city. It's told of a Phrygian king, which was one of the regions included in the empire, that was the subject of this tale and this legend. It comes from a number of sources, and it's not always told exactly the same, but I'll give you a version of it. And that is that Dionysius, the god of wine, was traveling through the area of Phrygia, and somewhere along the way, they lost one of the little or lesser gods of nature called a satyr. And Dionysius never found this other companion. Later, King Midas happened to come across this satyr and eventually returned him to Dionysius. And Dionysius was so thankful to get this companion back that he offered the king a wish, anything that he wanted. And so he wished that everything he touched would turn to gold. And Dionysius cautioned him that maybe you ought to think about that, that maybe that's not such a good thing to wish for. But he insisted that that's what he wanted. And so that's the wish he got. So he found out very quickly that this was not such a good thing, that he touched food to eat it and it would turn to gold. He hugged his daughter and she turned to gold. Well, he soon realized this was a curse. And so he went back to Dionysius and begged that this wish be removed. Dionysius, in his mercy, told him that he should go and wash in the Pactolus River that I just mentioned, and the wish would be removed. And so that's what he did, and it said that when he did, he put his hands in the water, and gold just flowed from his fingers out into the water, and the wish was removed. And so that was the reason that people gave that the Pactolus River was called a golden sands, that it had gold in it. Actually, it was gold dust from the Tumulus River, Tumulus Mountains, that had washed into the river. But it provided an industry for Sardis from ancient times that was well known. And so it made Sardis very wealthy. And you can see here in the picture, just right on the edge of what used to be the Pactolus River, is a furnace that was used for refining the gold. They had a massive gold works, and this included gold coins and all sorts of other things that they made and were well known for it. Actually, it was a form of an alloy of actually gold and silver called electrum that they were especially known for. But Sardis had become the capital of the empire by the 8th century, and they had many kings. But the last king was named Croesus. And he ruled until 546 BC. He expanded the empire to its greatest extent, and he became a figure of myth himself. He was credited with issuing the first true gold coins, and he was renowned far and wide for his great wealth. And at the end of his reign, it had such a profound effect on the Greeks that they actually referenced their calendar to that date when his rule ended. The defeat of Croesus came with the Persians under Cyrus. Remember Cyrus in the Bible, who the Persian king who allowed the Jews to go back to Jerusalem. Well, historian Herodotus, was the one who tells the tale, the story of what happened and the Persian army, which was really not a match for the Lydian army, came up and approached the Lydian commander. Croesus decided that in his overconfidence, he'd just go and wipe them out. Well, it turned out the Persians fought pretty hard, and they pushed him back. And he ended up going all the way back and got back in his fortress that I just showed you. And he had plenty of confidence here. This was totally impregnable. no one could ever capture it, and so it lasted for about a siege lasted for about 2 weeks, 14 days, until one night there was a soldier standing on the wall during the night in an area that was pretty much unguarded part of the wall, and it was perhaps a section that looked like this with a very steep area. They thought no one would ever get up there and be a problem. But he happened to drop his helmet over the side, and it was probably made of copper, so it was pretty valuable, and he wanted to get it back. So he sneaked down either over or under a spot in the wall and made his way down through a little path and retrieved at the bottom his helmet and went back up. He didn't notice that a Persian soldier was watching and had seen him the whole time. And so he went back and told his commander, and the commander got some troops together, and they came back and they went back up that exact same spot and were able to get past the wall into the city and captured the city by surprise at night, and they captured the king as well as the entire army. And so that was the end of the rule of Croesus. Later, in about 218 BC, the Greeks did a very similar thing to a king that then ruled in Sardis. And there was a soldier there that was throwing garbage over the wall, a spot they always threw the garbage. And birds would come and eat on the top of the wall. And so they looked at that and realized that there must not be any soldiers there for the birds to come up. And so they, remembering the story of ancient times with Croesus, they went up the same spot, the same way, and they captured the city again. And so Sardis repeated the same mistake, this lack of vigilance and overconfidence. In the first century, Sardis never regained all of its might and power, but it was still a very wealthy city, had a lot of gold mining and commerce. There was farming out in that fertile land, and they had a textile industry that was also that they were known for. Had a population of about 100,000 in the first century, until an earthquake came in 17 AD and just about wiped out the city. It caught the people by surprise. It came at night, and they had their guard down. They had not noticed all the tremors that were coming before. And so it was a very terrible event. Tiberius, the emperor at the time, helped them rebuild the city, and only a small portion is actually excavated today that can be seen. And this is what most of the center city that's been excavated today. There's a large complex. It's part of the gymnasium and the field in front of that. Over to the left is the agora, where the main road would run up and down in that direction. And in between is a large synagogue of the Jews. The agora, which was over on that far left side, this is a picture of it. And in those times, the first century, that area to the left would be a big, wide main road. That was the main road of travel. And the agora sat right on the side of it with all its little shops and people and businesses going on there. And one of the stones of one of these little shops is the carving of a fish. I outlined it because it's a little hard to see. It's kind of faded in the rock. And this indicated that there was a Christian presence here at a fairly early time. And perhaps this little emblem was a way of marking, you know, where the Christians met, because at this time there really weren't, it wasn't likely there were any actual church buildings. Most of them met in houses, and this may have been a way of sort of designating some of those things. Next to that, you can see the agora in this illustration over on the left, the little covered shops. And then sandwiched in between that and the gymnasium complex was a basilica, a synagogue. It's the largest one ever found. And you can see how large it is compared to the rest of the structures there. The basilica design is one in which you have pillars that are raised up very high so that the roof is raised in order to allow windows near the top. Because according to Psalm 36:9, which says, "In thy light we see light," the Jews wanted to have natural light in their synagogue, which is why most of them were built with this basilica design. And so the entrance to the synagogue has a large court filled with mosaics. And then going into that major area that would seat about 1,000 people, there were mosaics all over the floor. They're all on the walls, very intricate mosaics, and many inscriptions that show the name of donors and what they donated. This is the other end, which has the Moses seat and the Torah closet. The Moses seat, where the most prominent one of the Jews or rabbis would sit, and the Torah closet, where the Torah scrolls would be kept. And there was actually one inscription among some of the floor mosaics that indicated that that the donor was a Jew who was on the city, was a city councilman. So you can imagine that this particular Jewish community was very prominent. The Jews had a very high standing in the community, and they had a very large population here. It's believed that the reason the population was so big in this area, particularly in Sardis, was because of the relocation of the Jews, both from the Babylonian captivity and the Assyrian captivity. And there are references in the text even that indicate this. For example, in Obadiah, there's a reference to a place called Sepharad, which is believed to be Sardis, where many of the captives were taken after the Babylonian captivity. And there's a reference in Joel that refers to the Grecians, who are believed to be the Greeks of this area, that took in and bought many of the captives during the occupation of the Syrians. So this large presence of the Jews was very significant in Sardis. And they were integrated in really with much of the life there. The gymnasium complex was right on, actually shared a wall with the synagogue. That's how close they were. In fact, it's believed that the synagogue was unusual in that it wasn't built on the foundation of an old synagogue, as most synagogues over time were, but it was built actually on the foundation, or even part of the foundation of the gymnasium. Might have even been part of a chamber of the gymnasium complex. So clearly the Jewish community had a very close ties to the Roman society. The palaestra courtyard on out in front of the gymnasium was a place of great activity of training and athletics and so forth. And there was a massive gymnasium that included a marble court that had the statues and altars and sacrifices of the cult of the emperor going on there on a daily basis. On the south side of the city, away from the city center, was the Temple of Artemis. And it was built probably in the 3rd century BC, but never completed. Here it is today, and you can see the remains of that. It was renovated and modified by the Romans during the 1st century quite a few times, and they modified the rooms and added statues of emperors for emperor worship and worshiping in them. And they continued the modifications and additions and construction all through that time. Much of it was never finished. There were places where they would put in foundations for a row of columns and then never installed the columns. So there was a tendency of the people, even at that time, to never finish what they started. Well, in the 1st century, Sardis, as you can see, had a reputation from the past. And you might say it was too wealthy for its own good. There was a Scottish archaeologist and a New Testament scholar named William Ramsay who wrote this. It was a city whose history conspicuously and preeminently blazoned forth the uncertainty of human fortunes, the weakness of human strength, and the shortness of the step which separates overconfident might from sudden and irreparable disaster. It was a city whose name was almost synonymous with pretentious, unjustified, promise unfulfilled, appearance without reality, confidence which heralded ruin. And it was this self-confidence that made the separation of the world very difficult for both the Jews and the Christians. The Jews had literally merged their walls in with the Greeks and the Romans. And the Christians had a hard time overcoming their own tendency of their character as the Sardinians in order to separate themselves from that. Now, about 8 years later, in 62 AD, Paul was in prison, and he wrote a letter to the Ephesian church. And this letter, called that we know of as the Book of Ephesians, was likely passed around to many people. In fact, you might call many of his letters traveling letters, even though he wrote them to perhaps a specific place. I'm sure Paul expected that they would be read by many. In fact, some of them were actually specified that they be read in different places by different people. And so since they didn't have a post office service where he could just put a letter in a mail and put a stamp on it and send it, they were usually sent by messengers. And so you can imagine a messenger carrying the letter to the city of Ephesus and the believers there. And as they did, they passed through a number of cities with believers, and they'd probably have that letter in their pocket, and the believers would kind of want to know, what's Paul writing to them? And they'd probably pull it out and read it. So very quickly, they would have copies, and they would read, and it was spread around. And so the letters became very important. They didn't have the text that we have, and so those letters were probably copied. In fact, we know they were copied many times throughout the year, throughout the years. And so by the time it got to Ephesus, it was certainly something that was intended for the Ephesians to read, but you can imagine that it wouldn't be long before it would be passed around. In a city like Sardis, being as close as it was, and people traveling back and forth, you can imagine that it wasn't long before Sardis also probably had a chance to see that letter from Paul. There were probably believers in Ephesus who had it in their pocket when they traveled to Sardis, and the believers wanted to share these different things. In fact, it was probably almost the equivalent of what we would call like a radio ministry. They didn't have that in the day. But if a person wrote something or said something, this was the way they could communicate it. This is the way they could get it around, was to make copies and share it and so forth. Let me read a portion that perhaps the believers in one church may have shared with Sardis if this letter got passed around. Turn over to Ephesians 5, verse 11. I'm going to start there and just read a few verses. And have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove or expose them, the word means. And then in verse 13, but all things that are reproved or exposed are made manifest by the light, for whatsoever doth make manifest is light. Wherefore he saith, awake, thou that sleepest, and arise from the dead, and Christ shall give thee light. This is taken from Isaiah chapter 60. See that thou walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. Wherefore, be ye not unwise, but understanding what the will of the Lord is. You can imagine that the Ephesians certainly would have taken this in as Paul's instruction for them. But notice in verse 14, he contrasts those that are dead in sin, that is unbelievers, to those that are alive in light. We have the word awake, which is a word that means to come out of sleep, or actually come out of another state, as if waking up. And it's a term that's used for the miracle of raising from the dead, often in the text, used many times in that way. And then the word arise, which means to get up or rise up after awaking. In other words, get up and take action. Don't be like the dead in sin. Don't be like you're in darkness. So when you get up, the Lord would provide light, as the verse says. And then in verse 17, with this light, you'll see his will. In fact, it can't be understood without the light, and you can't even be alive without the light. So when you think about it, this passage in some ways, and to some people whom it would have addressed in Ephesus and other places, was almost an evangelistic message. It was to those dead in sin, but it was also an indication to believers that they couldn't carry on their mission unless they stopped acting like and living like they were dead and in darkness. And so the Ephesians certainly needed to hear this, and some probably did need to wake up dead in sin, and others needed to live like they weren't dead. They needed to wake up, get up, and get going and light the way as they went. This was the message. But it was also likely shared in Sardis, as I mentioned, not very many miles away. And so long before John's message, letters like this, these traveling letters, would have been in the hands and in the ears of Sardis, 30 years before the book of Revelation and John's letter to them. And so now if we just quickly, in the little bit of time we have left, just want to flip over to Revelation chapter 3. This is the place you're familiar with regarding the city of Sardis. And think now that this message for John, as he wrote this down, was probably not news to him, but it was an earnest final call to the Sardinians. They had heard this before. They'd probably read it in letters from Paul and heard it preached. And now the reputation of Sardis, which was widespread and anciently known, was coming finally into question. And the Christian community there was really expected to rise above this reputation, take on the responsibility to be light, as they had been told, to spread the gospel further at a time when the message was fresh and the world was freshly ready to hear it. They needed to finish what they started and to stand out different from the average Sardinians, and that's what they hadn't done. So while John was on Patmos, these churches were probably relatively close in his mind. After all, the farthest one away was hardly more than 100 miles from Ephesus, where he'd spent many years. And he probably knew them. He knew their problems. He knew many of them by name. And so when the Lord told John to write, he probably wasn't real surprised at what the message was going to be to these various churches. But it wasn't just old John preaching now, and it wasn't just those letters from Paul. This was directly from the Lord this time. Many years later, not back in the 50s or the 60s when those letters came through, but this was now in the 90s. And so we read just a couple of verses there in verse 2 and 3, or actually starting kind of the last half of verse 1. I know thy works, that thou hast a name, but there that thou livest, but there you're dead. Be watchful, strengthen the things which remain that are ready to die, for I have not found those works perfect before God. Remember, therefore, how thou hast received and heard and held and hold fast, repent. If therefore thou shalt watch, I will come. If thou shalt not watch, I will come as a thief, and thou shalt not know the hour I will come upon thee. Now in Sardis, this word name that's used here, their reputation they had of being alive. The people of Sardis had a very long-standing reputation, as I said, of being very confident and knowledgeable. But most of them were actually dead and unaware, just as Sardis had been in the past. In verse 2, the word perfect is a word that actually means completed or fulfilled, something not finished. But if it was started and done, it wasn't done as it was done as man-pleasers, not God-pleasers. It wasn't done in the right way. And so their mission was to be light and spread the gospel. That was what was being challenged. And just as with the Ephesians, they couldn't fulfill this mission if they were either dead in sin or acted like they were dead. And so the letter was really written to both of those people. There were a few that were not dead, and it was especially written to them. The church was about to die. The verses say its membership was more and more a roll of dead people, unbelievers, and fewer believers. Soon the whole church would just be dead people. The word watchful that's in verse 2 and 3 is the same word that's used in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. This was probably another one of those traveling letters, and it was written a number of years before, a few years prior to the time that Paul is venturing across in chapter 19. And in it, we read in verse 2 and 3, but ye brethren, and I meant to flip the slide here, but ye brethren are not in darkness, that day should overtake you as a thief. Ye are all children of light and the children of day, and are not of the light, not of darkness. Therefore, let us not sleep as others do, but let us watch and be sober. Very similar words, very similar admonition. Not to sleep or be dead, but watch. So what were they to watch for? What was that word watch used for, both in Revelation and here? Well, to the Thessalonians, it was very clear. Paul was explaining that they were to watch for the coming of Christ. They were to look out for him and let that inspire them in what they should get done. Sardis was told exactly the same thing, only it was a little more imminent. The Lord said, I'm coming, and I'm going to catch you unawares if you're not watching. The same message. While watching, they needed to complete to fulfillment the things they were given to do, but not just in any way, but in a way that was acceptable to God. The word before that is used there in verse 2 means literally in the eye of. In other words, under God's watch, in his presence, you're to be doing it. You're to please him. And there's also a little word that's missing in a lot of translations. It's at the end of the Greek sentence. It's a little word, mal, which means of me or my. And so really this would read acceptable or perfect in the eyes of my God. And remember, Jesus is the one speaking. And so he's saying that the one watching, the one whose eye it is in front of, is God the Father. The church belongs to Jesus. He wanted it to be presentable to his Father, to God. And so it's in his eyes that you're doing this. Otherwise, it'd be a surprise as a thief in the night, repeating the past, just another page in the disappointing history of Sardis. So in conclusion, I want to go back to that question that I raised, or that Turkish archaeologist C.C. Tucker raised. Did they fulfill their mission? And I want you to look, well, I want you to look first here, the very back of that picture. And you may notice, right in the corner, a little brown spot in the back of the ruins of the Temple of Artemis. If you're not sure what that could be, let's just walk all the way to the back and turn around and look at it from the other side. It turns out that there was a church that was built on top of the ruins of this temple. The temple went out of favor with the Romans by the end of the 3rd century and was no longer really in use. Sometime not too long after that, a church was built there. Perhaps one of the first real buildings of a church in that city. It was actually started when the original construction was maybe 2/3 the size of that, just a little thing that was added onto. It was a growing church built on the ruins. And on the doorpost of the church were a couple of Greek words. One means light and one means life, carved into the doorpost. Perhaps these were Jewish Christians and they wanted to write on the doorpost as Deuteronomy 6:9 instructed them to do. But as Christians, they wrote these words instead of what the Jews would normally write, the Shema, on the doorpost. And lead you to believe that maybe they actually did read Ephesians 5:14, that Christ shall give thee light. And maybe they actually took heed of the words of Revelation 3:5, the 5th verse there in that letter. He that overcometh, the same shall be clothed in white raiment, and I shall not blot out his name with the book of life. So unlike the synagogue that was built and grafted into the walls, this little church was built on the ruins, defiant of the world, standing out as different. About 60 years later, there was a pastor of this church that is written about, and he was a well-educated Greek convert named Mileto, and he soon became the leader of all the churches in Asia. And he wrote a number of writings. He appeared to follow the writings of John, particularly the Gospel of John, and he even was bold enough to write a defense of Christianity and presented it to the current emperor, Marcus Aurelius. So although we can't be sure, we certainly see some evidence here that the church at Sardis, with their place, may have taken on finally the responsibility that they should have taken, that they had not merged in with the world and done as the Jews and as even their predecessors had done, but they had accepted the challenge. And that's the same challenge that we as Christians must accept today, to not share the wall with the world. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for another time to get together and just hear from your word. We pray that we would take heed of these words and this admonition to not act as those that are dead, but to take on the mission you've given us to share the gospel, to be the ones that stand out and not merge with the world. I pray for all of us this week that we will find opportunities to serve you in a way that would honor you, and that we would be responsive and alert for those opportunities. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.